Up next, from the O'Reilly Media Open Source Convention, it's Rommel Lefkowitz with part three of his always popular The Semasiology of Open Source, from Open Source Conversations on the GigaVox Media Network. This is Doug Kay from GigaVox Media, and today it's my pleasure to bring you another presentation from OSCON, the O'Reilly Media Open Source Convention. The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and if you'd like us to produce new and even more exciting programs in the future, we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. Thank you, Limelight, for your support of the Conversations Network. And now, here's our presentation from OSCON.
This is the Semasiology of Open Source, part three. The reason it is part three is because the structure of classical rhetorical argument demanded that there be the statement of the thesis, exploration of the antithesis, and then the synthesis. And therefore, I am required, after having presented in past the thesis and the antithesis, to present the synthesis. Semasiology is, from the semantics, it is the study of the change in the meaning of words over time. And this is a non-linear synthesis, so it's difficult to know where to begin, and I need a jumping-off point. Jumping-off point is a presentation that Bruce Sterling did at ETEC earlier this year, in which he's talking about spines and what a spine is and how he came to coin the word, and he makes the following statement. Adam Greenfield is trying to speak and think very clearly and to avoid internecine definitional struggles, which was a marvelous turn of phrase. As a literary guy, though, I think these definitional struggles are a positive force for good. It's a sign of creative health to be bogged down in internecine definitional struggles. It means we have escaped the previous definitional box. For a technologist, the bog is a rather bad place, because it makes it harder to sell the product. In literature, the bog of definitional struggle is the most fertile area. That is what literature is. It's taming reality with words. Literature means that we're trying to use words to figure out what things mean and how we should feel about that. And so I take exception to this on two grounds. The first is that he's confusing technologist with salesman. And the second is that he thinks that literature is about using words and figuring out what they mean. And he goes on to talk about how artificial intelligence was an example of bad use of words. And so that is, in fact, going to be our jumping off point, because what is artificial intelligence? Artificial intelligence was the study of an intellectual hybrid of philosophy, linguistics, mathematics, and electrical engineering, and to which I would add biology. And that is the springboard to the actual jumping off point, which is this book, Understanding Computers and Cognition, A New Foundation for Design by Terry Winograd and Fernando Flores. This book is pivotal and a great place to start this discussion. This book, I didn't read the book when it originally came out, but Terry Winograd presented at a keynote at OOPSLA, which is the Object-Oriented Programming Systems and Languages Conference, sponsored by the ACM, and he gave the keynote where he talked about the language action perspective, which is what this book introduced. Such a pivotal book that the May issue of the Communications of the ACM this year featured an entire article on 20 years of the language action perspective. So who was Terry Winograd, and why was this book so pivotal? Terry Winograd was the author of Shridloo. Shridloo was a program written between 1968 and 1970, which did natural language recognition. So a program that would be able to hold a conversation with you. Now, we'd only be able to have this conversation about this micro-universe, which was Bloch's world, but it could talk about blocks in an astonishingly coherent way. It was the wonder hack of the 70s. All right? People said, AI is finally here. This thing is going to be able to pass the Turing test. There were snippets of the conversations that people would discuss endlessly. One of them would be, why did you put the block, you know, the red block on the blue block would be the transcript. And the computer would answer, well, because you told me to. So it was great. And one of the interesting things about Sridhu is it didn't have a dictionary. Map each word to a subroutine, a program, and then as it was trying to figure out what the sentence meant, it was actually involved executing these things recursively until it figured out what to do next. So that was the sentence analysis. When Winograd started talking about the language action perspective, he said mostly it's about two notions. And the two are that language is action. And the action specifically is commitments. That what people do when they use language is they are seeking to make or not make or avoid or propose commitments. And that's the sole purpose of language, and that all information is communication. The problem, he said, is that artificial intelligence research as we're doing it today, today being 1986, is predicated on the notion that sentences have meaning. That when you have a statement in a language, it says something about the world, and it can have a truth value. The thing that it can be saying can be true or false. And that the way you know what the sentence is saying is because it has something to do with the words which it contains, the meanings of those words, and how those words are combined. And therefore, you can take this whole thing apart, you can analyze it, and you can figure out what it means. And in the book, Understanding Computers and Cognition, he says, this is actually not true. This is a false premise. Therefore, AI is not going to work. It does not make sense to ask whether an utterance is true or false because it inherently has no meaning. What you can ask is whether it is felicitous, whether it's useful in the context in which it is uttered, because the context in which it is uttered is some negotiation about commitments. Does this help? So he gives a number of examples, and he starts with water. You ask the question, is there water in the refrigerator? Well, what does water mean? What are possible answers to this question? Well, yes, there's water in the refrigerator in the cells of the eggplant there on the second shelf. So well, that might be a smart alecky answer. How about, yes, condensed on the bottom of the cooling coils? Well, that's also a smart alecky answer. He says, well, but what if the context is, I left some photographic plates in the refrigerator. They seem to have been ruined by exposure to moisture. Is there water in the refrigerator? Why, yes, condensing on the coils. Aha, you had some context. You were thinking about drinking water. Right? Is there water in the refrigerator? Well, no, there's no water in the refrigerator, but there's some lemonade. Or, yes, there is a bottle of water, but I put some drops of lemon in it in order to take out the taste of the rust from the water dripping on it from the condensing coils. Is it lemonade or is it? What does water mean? So it doesn't mean anything just by looking at it. You can make any of these statements, and they can be felicitous or not felicitous, but they can't be true or false. The other way that you have problems in figuring out what something means is at what level of discourse are you looking at the situation? What is it that you are trying to analyze? Right? What is the commitment you are seeking from this communication? What is this person doing? Well, here's some proposed answers that Terry Winograd suggests. Right, sitting at a desk, moving a pen over a piece of paper, or writing English text, or reminding an administrative assistant about next week's contract meeting, or trying to improve the efficiency of the office by changing the way we deal with contracts. These are all true statements, or they're false statements, or you know, but the question is which ones are felicitous, and as what is the context in which you are asking these questions. Language is just actions in a space of commitments. They don't mean anything in and of themselves, separated from the commitments that you're seeking to accept, reject, deny, negotiate. And then once, and I gotta say, this is it's an interesting pamphlet, 200 pages or so. I highly recommend it since it's a 20-year anniversary, because I'm not gonna be able to do it justice in the 5 minutes that I can talk about it. So if you're not actually saying anything, then it actually moves the whole notion of what it is that you're trying to do with computers from making decisions because you have all this data and input of things that you know and that you're trying to analyze them to see what you can infer therefrom, to building a consensus. The reason that you're engaging in this language is that you are trying to influence others to commit, and you are not analyzing to decide. And that changes the whole structure of what it is that you're engaged in. When I saw this statement, I thought, geez, we talk a lot about this when we start talking about open source, that there's some notion that the important thing is getting influencing other people to travel the same road that you're traveling. And therefore, if things don't mean anything in and of themselves, except for the context, then understanding is not actually related to looking at the content and extracting meaning from it, but it's merely yet another commitment, right? To suggest that you understand something is that you are committed to keep negotiating what this thing possibly means until you arrive at some mutually satisfactory condition, or until you find that the distinctions that you're making with the words that you're using aren't sufficient, and you need to find new distinctions and maybe make up new words. Now, here's a funny thing. Terry Winograd was at the MIT AI Labs while Richard Stallman was at the MIT AI Labs. And so the centrality of getting people to work together and looking for where the meaning was is what AI was all about. AI is about living in that bog of internecine definitional struggles that Bruce Sterling was talking about, right? And when you start thinking about the language action perspective, as was laid down in 1986, it has a tremendous amount of resonance for open source. Software is not a product, right? It's not content. It's not a message that has some information encoded in it. It's a component of a process. It's an expression of a commitment.
So how do you go from speech to software here?
What? How do we go from speech to software?
You just talked about sentences and meaning evaluated software.
We're in the domain. The question is, how do we get from speech to software? We are talking about communication, right? Messages, information theory, right? And the passing of messages contain information. And so it is one way of thinking about that. Or the passing of messages is a linguistic action seeking to negotiate commitments, right? And then so you're not talking about the artifact, you're talking about the process. And the analogy that I make then is, in open source software, you are less interested in the artifact than you are in the process and the set of commitments that surrounds that process. Open source recasts software development as an ongoing dialogue between the producers, consumers, maintainers, users, et cetera, of the software. Which then means, Doc, that not only are markets conversations. Everything is a conversation.
It's like the blank title in Scrabble. You can use it anywhere and it has no value.
So when what is central to the whole act of communication, where understanding and meaning emerge, is at the breakdowns. Right? Water doesn't mean anything until you think you understood what you meant by water, you get an infelicitous response, and then you have to negotiate, well, what exactly did you mean when you said water? Or why did you want to know? I'm going to be talking about breakdowns and the importance of failure in open source tomorrow, so I'm not going to dwell on this aspect today. But when he's talking about breakdowns, and I just have to throw this in because I have a certain fascination with words that some of you may have picked up on. And he's talking about breakdowns in the context of software development, because the man, after all, was a computer scientist, and this was it's a book about cognition and computing. It's an artificial intelligence text. And he's saying that most failures of large computer systems have not been caused by simple breakdowns in functionality, but by breakdowns in a larger web of computing. And the word web just caught my eye there for a second, and he footnotes this reference, and he says the term web of computing is from a paper by Kling and Saki, The Web of Computing, Computing Technology as Social Organization. This paper is from 1982, based on empirical studies of experience with large-scale computer systems in a social context. And I thought, wow, that's a sort of an early reference for Web 2.0.
0.5.
Or Web 0.1. And in chapter 9 of this book, Winograd, the wonder child of AI, natural language recognition, makes the following statement. Our position then, in accord with the preceding chapters, is that computers cannot understand language. And this sentence purportedly caused the nuclear winter for AI. As he talks more about that, he suggests that language, over and over again, it's a point of the language action perspective, language is a medium for expressing these commitments. So if I were to write something down and mail it to you, right, you would not be tempted to see the paper as exhibiting language behavior. But if I write a complex computer program that responds to things you type, the program is still a medium through which my commitments to you are conveyed. There's no information per se in the program. The program isn't important. What is important is what commitments am I making to you? What commitments are you seeking from me? I'm sorry? Doesn't that ignore emergent behavior is the question, because paper can't have emergent behavior, but programs can. And I believe what Terry Winograd is saying is no, programs can't. Now, he might have been wrong. but that's what he said. And I want to follow this thread to see where we wind up if we bring it into the 21st century. I must take a brief digression, because while I was reading up on the language action perspective and where AI had been, I stumbled across Wittgenstein's Beetle in the context of what exactly does open source mean and what are we talking about in terms of the meaning of open source. Wittgenstein's Beetle was a thought experiment conducted by the philosopher Wittgenstein. Remember, we're talking, this is a computer science talk, we're talking about computer science, artificial intelligence, which is a blend of philosophy, linguistics, biology, computer science. Wittgenstein's Beetle is the philosophy part. He performs the following thought experiment. He says, supposing everybody has a matchbox. In their matchbox, they have something, or maybe nothing, we don't know. But everybody has a matchbox. Nobody's allowed to look into anybody else's matchbox. And the thing you have in your matchbox, you call a beetle. And the thing I have in my matchbox, I call a beetle. And then the question is, what does beetle mean? And how do you arrive at the meaning of beetle? This is obviously true for words like love and hate, which is what Wittgenstein talks about as a philosopher. What does love mean? Love is my beetle. Yeah. What is love? Your love is your beetle. But Winograd extends this to water. What does water mean? Well, it depends on the context. Right? So everything really is a beetle. And I thought, wow, that's pretty impressive. 1953. How old is this thought? Luckily, I have books. So when I search things, the search proceeds linearly along my bookshelf. And the book next to Wittgenstein's Beetle was The Basic Writings of Sun Tzu, who was a Confucian philosopher around 250 BC. And he has the following interesting observation in a chapter on advising the ruler on the correct use of language. Names, says Sun Tzu, have no intrinsic appropriateness. And if you want to follow along, everywhere you see the word appropriate, you can substitute felicitous. One agrees to use a certain name and issues an order to that effect, and if the agreement is abided by and becomes a matter of custom, then the name may be said to be appropriate. But if people do not abide by the agreement, then the name ceases to be appropriate.
Sounds like
DNS. Sounds like the open source definition. I define it thusly. And if that agreement is abided by and becomes a matter of custom, then it is so. I had to do this because if I did not have this slide, I would have had no references in this presentation to anything that happened before the Christian era, and that would have been unusual. Magic is one of those words that means different things depending on the context. We think of it now as card tricks, but of course magic at one point was much more than card tricks. It included alchemy, which was chemistry, but it also included, as anybody who has seen the Harry Potter series knows, you have to be able to utter the correct spell with the correct pronunciation. Right? Language is the original magic. And this is a theme that apparently not only permeates the computer science that Winograd was working on, artificial intelligence, but also science fiction literature. Snow Crash is all about the magic of language and how you can control the world through language. Well, it was also Stranger in a Strange Land. Right? And in fact, that word is grok. What does grok mean? And this discussion is between the linguist from the Martian expedition, Mahmoud, and Jubal. He says, take this word grok. Its literal meaning means to drink. Jubal is surprised. He says, no, it doesn't mean to drink. It means to understand. So they ask Mike, the Martian. They said, what does it mean? He says, yes, it means to drink. It also means fear. It means love. It means hate. It means identically equal in the mathematical sense. It means a whole bunch of stuff kind of depending on context. In fact, language is magical. It's mystical. How do you teleport? How do you learn how to program computers? Well, you know, if you've never studied electronics, it's hard. But if you took the time to sweat and learn, says Jubal, the language of electronics, I don't think it's miraculous, just complex. And teleportation is quite simple, really, once you learn the language. That's the punchline. Language is mystical and magical and has been so all along. And that's where the study of artificial intelligence went. How do we understand language? And we conclude you can't understand language because it's magical. But it has tremendous power. This is a set of books that I had in 1950. It's published in 1956. I got it as a child. Probably the reason that I grew up to be interested in mathematics. And one of the things in there, of course, is Turing's original article on the Turing test. How would you tell if a machine could think? And the test is a language test. Can it master language? Because that is where the magic is. That's why Shridloo was such a big deal, because it seemed to master language. Right? Paul Graham talks about this in a great article he has called The Blub Paradox, right? That programming languages vary in power. All things being equal, you should use the more powerful language. And then he goes on to say, well, there are many exceptions to this rule, but I don't think that's really the case. There are no exceptions to this rule. You should always use the more powerful language. Problem is, what do you mean by powerful? And that might vary depending on your context. Blub, programming languages, he goes on to say, is how programmers communicate, which brings us back full circle to where does the meaning lie? Why do we do open source? We do open source. Why do we think that's important? Well, we think it's important because languages are magical. So we need to see the source, because the source is the language, right? And the power comes from the fact that we are using the program to create community and communicate with each other and make commitments to each other. I just have to briefly talk on linguistics, because artificial intelligence is sort of a blend of all of these things. And in the language imperative, I ran across a reference to the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which says, basically, that how you understand the world is related to how you speak about the world, what language you speak. If you speak different languages, you can look at the same thing and see it differently. And there are many examples throughout the book. It's kind of an interesting book to read. Esther Dyson winds up getting quoted in there for various reasons, because there's a convergence of linguistics, language, programming, computers. And lastly, for the set of things that inform the study of artificial intelligence and computer science, in reaction to Bruce Sterling's assertion that it is the people involved in literature that are interested in words and their meaning. John Casty has this great book talking about the five most important theorems of the 20th century, and he chooses important, not necessarily that they're important mathematically, but that they had implications to culture and the way we thought of the world. And one of those five is Turing's proof of the halting theorem. And in the same chapter, he covers Gödel's proof of the undecidability proposition, because he asserts there were actually the same proof, just in different domains. But the structure of the proof and the structure of what they asserted was the same. But what was interesting about those And this book goes into Gödel's proof in more detail. This is probably the finest book that I on artificial intelligence and computers and meaning and understanding and so forth. You can read it slightly longer than the Winograd book. It weighs in at 750 pages, and the first 500 are introduction. To set the context so that you can understand the solution to the proof of Gödel's theorem, but I can recommend it. This book won the Pulitzer Prize, which is kind of bizarre if you think about it for a book that spends 500 pages trying to explain to you Gödel's proof.
But it is a very fun
book. And he explores language and the meaning of things and where is the meaning, because if you're going to talk about Gödel's proof, you need to understand that. Because what, in order to prove what these gentlemen proved, what you do is you map statements and proofs and theorems and machines onto integers. And that way, each integer means something. And then you can do some math and wind up at paradoxes like dividing by zero type things. So you're saying, well, therefore, if this meant that, then we have proven whatever it was that we were setting out to prove. But then, of course, you look at that number and you say, well, the number actually doesn't mean that. I mean, that's just some context that you supply, and it could mean something completely differently, right? It could actually be a program stored on a CD. It could be Microsoft Windows. I mean, that same integer, really, if you looked at the bits, could be that. You don't know. So where the meaning comes from is extrinsic to the actual thing itself, right? So the hunt for meaning and language permeates all of this. And the one quote that I want to pull out of the 750-page tome is, as long as a program is running correctly, it hardly matters how you describe it or think of its functioning. It is when something goes wrong. It is when you have a breakdown in the language action perspective. Then you need to be able to think of it at a different level than you were thinking about it when you were trying to use it. That's when you want to see the source. That's why Richard Stallman only got exercised with his printer driver when it wasn't working. And this book predates the other by 10 years, came out in 1977.
But define working.
It's a beetle. Correct. But he only felt moved to make that assertion when he thought it was not working. Until that moment, he was not perturbed by the reality of what was going on. So meaning emerges. If we go back to Winograd, meaning emerges, distinctions emerge from negotiating around the breakdowns in attempting to secure commitments. And that's exactly what happened to Richard.
Even if the closed source printer driver insists that the beetle is not a bug.
Well, we're going to come to that precise point in a moment. This is scene two, act one, context. Scene three is commitments. I'm sorry, act three is commitments, and we will address it there. So, I know that it's today. We're zooming along. I am only about 10 minutes behind schedule. So, context. In the last two parts, it's been a great deal. What is open source? And we explored, you know, various possible meanings for open source. So this is in the way of review, right? And this is the way of a historical review. Initially, it was kind of an educational thing. Universities did it because it was all about learning and passing on information, publish or perish. And on the downside, you know, there's no formal review. It's not refereed publication, so it's really not education. You know, things are popularity contests that win. It's not necessarily good research and so forth. So in each one of these contexts, there's kind of they're good things, they're bad things. People discuss it, but they discuss it within the context. And if you stay within that context, you don't have the breakdowns. And then it became a political movement, right? So it's all about freedom. And then when it's all about freedom, then, you know, you wind up saying, oh, well, you get involved in political issues and changing legislations and patent law and whether it's free or not free. And that becomes sort of the context of discussion. Your beetle is freedom, right? And then we said, oh, no, business. Business is the context that we ought to be talking about this because software is a business, right? And now an important distinction emerged. There was this huge breakdown. Right? So you want to have different words. So the word for open source when you're talking about politics is free software, but the word for open source when you're talking about business is open source. right? But we don't have a separate word for what open source is when you're talking about academia, but that's okay because we don't talk to those people very much. All right, so there's a set of distinctions that you make in business, and I'm not gonna talk about that because everybody's talking about that. Right, and so lately it's moved into the standard space, and people are talking about, you know, what's the relationship between open source and standards? Standards are open source, standards aren't open source, standards complement open source. I happen to hold the position that standards and open source are opposites and antonyms, and I wish I could talk about that today, but I don't have the time, so I won't. And then there's a different context that you get into, which is, it's a software engineering context, right? We're talking about software, this is all about software engineering. It's good software engineering, no, it's bad software engineering. Right, because obviously, if you think about it, traditionally, right, how do you do good software engineering? Well, you do modular things. How can you tell if it's modular? It has well-defined interfaces. How do you know well-defined interfaces? Well, you don't need to look at the source code to know what it's doing. You could just talk to the interface. Therefore, if you needed to have the source code, by definition, it's poor software engineering. No. You're talking about manufacturing software. We're talking about maintenance, which is a much bigger problem in this century. Right? Now, if you're doing maintenance and you have to have access to the software, then it makes all bugs shallow because you can like read the code and so forth, and that's an excellent discussion, and I will be having that one tomorrow, so I'm not going to talk about it today. So I have a different context to talk about, and that is, this is my beetle. These are not bugs. Which is professionalism, or labor relations. I was going to call this section professional open source, but I can't because it's trademarked. No, it's trademarked. By JBoss when I found it in the Google cache, but Red Hat today. So what do we mean by professional? Well, it's kind of a beetle. Depends on your context. And in some contexts, it is felicitous to use it when you're referring to people who get paid as opposed to people who don't get paid. And that is one sense of the use of the word professional and profession. But professional and profession actually comes from this notion that has something to do about serving the public and having standards and being certified. Here's a great one from Pennsylvania Legal Code. All right, to a point here that one of the things, you know, condition precedent to the performance of the service is the obtaining of a license. And I think license in this sense not being obsolete in the sense that we discussed this morning. And professional services, of course, any type of services that may be rendered by a member of a profession, which by definition is somebody who has a license from the state. In which case, in that beetle, well, software engineers are not professionals. Right? A professional, this is the Wikipedia entry, is a member of a licensing body which is legally established. Aha! Are there any professionals in the room? No, good, then I will not be offending anybody moving on. This book, also written in 1977, same time as Gerd Lescherbach, which I came across, which started me down this line of thinking, it is called Programmers and Managers, The Routinization of Computer Programming in the United States. It is written by a German gentleman.
It's subtitled Wishful Thinking.
And he makes some interesting observations, which I will share with you at the risk of offending, because you may disagree. In 1832, Charles Babbage, of computer science fame, turned out he was also, I guess, some kind of an entrepreneur. And he was talking about how it is that one can more effectively manufacture goods. And he makes the following assertions. The master manufacturer divides the work to be executed into different processes, each requiring different degrees of skill or force. Because then you can optimize the labor. You can get a workman who has this much skill and that much force. Whereas, if you were to have one workman, you might have too much of one or the other, and that would be less efficient. So you can gain more efficiency by dividing the work. So what Dr. Kraft says is, thinking about this another way, in a society based upon the purchase and sale of labor, dividing the craft cheapens its individual parts. We know this. We are software engineers. This is what we do. You take something and you break it down into modular components because then you can control them better. You can manage them more easily. And the same is true of labor. If you de-skill the labor, you make each component easier to do, you get a more interchangeable workforce, it's easier to manage the production process, and that is how you increase productivity, increase profits. And so this movement, which began around the time of Charles Babbage in the 1800s, the Industrial Revolution, was all about this insight that if you modularized the components of things, you could manage them more effectively and you could be more efficient. And the class of person who did that in every domain were called engineers. The engineer's job was to rearrange, redesign, simplify things, and possibly simplify them to the point where you could build machines that could do them, that they were so simple. Obviously, people are smarter, better than machines. But if you get it simple enough, you could turn it into machines. And this was what Norbert Wiener was concerned about, because once you have machines doing labor, why? And Norbert Wiener was the father of cybernetics. He invented, in some beetle, this notion of automating things with computers, is that things done by computers or robots were socially equivalent to slave labor, because you owned machines. You didn't hire them. And therefore, workforces would have to compete with slave labor. And when you have to compete with slave labor, you become slave labor. So he was very concerned about this potential dark, dystopian future that he saw emerging from the spread of computers. And then Dr. Kraft makes this observation, which is what got me thinking about this whole thing. So I actually started here and then backed up to there, and now we're back to where I started. Structured programming, modularization, and so forth are actually good things in the hands of skilled people. It's excellent engineering technique. It does, in fact, make things better, but there is an organizational and a social implication of what happens when you do that, and the context in which you are motivated to do that. And the context in which engineers are motivated to do that is different than the context that managers are motivated to do that. And their motivation is not to make better programs, but to make it easier to manage programmers. So structured programming is about de-skilling the programming labor force. And that he predicted that there would be subspecialties, and that you would see, because in those days you had analysts and programmers.
Or traders.
Well, this is a picture of traders, but yeah. But they all have terminals. And now, of course, we have QA people, and scripters, and business analysts as opposed to systems analysts. So in fact, we have seen this modularization of the workforce. And the definition that businesses use when they talk about software jobs as being professional jobs is different than the professional definition that we engaged in earlier. Now, this is in 1977, and Dr. Kraft makes the observation, of course, that barely a generation after its inception, programming is no longer the complex work of creative and perhaps even eccentric people. Now, since I'm talking to a room full of eccentric people, at least, and certain possibly creative as well, this may seem not to ring true, but as you go further, he realizes he's talking about, well, there are still people who do that kind of stuff. There's still people engaged in that kind of work. It's not to say that the creativity and eccentricity has disappeared. It's just that as a proportion of the people who are doing this kind of work, they are a smaller and smaller percentage, that more and more people are, in fact, doing work that is less and less indistinguishable, less and less distinguishable from assembly line work, clerical work. That's de-skilling. And he asserts that three things are driving that: the extensive use of prepackaged programs, so you don't need to be as skilled, changes in the way programming is done, meaning methodologies like structured programming, and changes in the way programming work is organized. And at this morning said, people are the most important thing in open source. And that's what we're talking about here. That open source, this context, the beetle that we want to be talking about, what originally interested me in open source was the idea that I had that What open source did was it opened the possibility to change the way that we think about organizing the workers who work on producing software. Now, there's a couple of different ways that you can do that. Dr. Kraft, a little more, I was going to use the word socialist, but a little more liberal in his views of social change, might be thinking of it more in terms of how you would use the reality of open source to have more like thinking of it more like a kind of a collective bargaining, unionizing, right? Workers basically having allegiance to something which was not their employer, right? Developing skills that they could transfer from one employer to another, right? So that these things would be a way of organizing the workers separately from the way that their managers would want to organize them. And you could take that tack, but if you were, again, as with all of the other contexts that we said, a little more on the conservative, right-leaning side, and I don't have a fabulous picture of George Bush to put up there, then you might be thinking of it more as the construction of a professional organization where you would have certifying bodies and legal licensing, and you'd be required to have a license before you would be allowed to fire up an IDE, right? And you would have a title associated with your name if you had passed the bar, or whatever we would call the thing that you would have to pass in order to become a licensed software professional. And, you know, we could refer to each other as doctor. Or
committer.
having seen access databases and Excel spreadsheets in the hand of end users, so that might not be a bad thing.
yes, the assertion is made that might not be a bad thing, and I am scrupulously attempting to avoid making a value judgment on which one of these paths we might want to pursue, and merely trying to reframe the discussion around not freedom, not business, not education, not standards, but labor organization and professionalism, whichever side of that divide you might come down on. And that was the discussion that I thought I was going to be having when I engaged people in the discussion of open source. And there was a sort of a long tradition of trade unions that came out of benefits societies and other such things, which have many of the same kinds of words that we use when we talk about the open source community and other idealistic parts of the movement. So it turned out, after all that, that Samasiology of open source applied to everybody. Everybody's definition of what they thought it meant was changing over time, and mine included. And the meaning, of course, cannot be legislated by some emperor, as Sun Tzu so rightly observed. It is the consensus that emerges at the breakdowns with the discussions. And I am one of those for whom open source does not mean what I think it means. Or, to put it another way, my definition of open source is not felicitous. So that's why I had ACM on my badge. I'm a member of the ACM, I'm a member of the IEEE. These are organizations seeking to achieve professional status for software engineers. The observation that Dr. Kraft makes in his book is that the grunts of the programming world do not participate in these organizations for many reasons. Mostly they don't think it's relevant. And that may be true, it may not be relevant, but how do we organize ourselves, right? We organize ourselves around projects, but I don't know that that's sufficient. We organize ourselves around languages because those are magical. And that's where the power is in the magic. But maybe there should be some other way, some other organization, some other means of helping us restructure the way we organize the labor force. All right, so commitments. This is an answer to your question, sir. Bertrand Meyer, in the March 2000 issue of Software Development Magazine, made an interesting observation. He made a lot of very inflammatory observations. But there was one that I thought was particularly interesting, which was he drew attention to this paragraph, all in uppercase letters, except when otherwise stated in writing to copyright holders, other parties, etc. There's no warranty of any kind, express or implied, including but not limited to the implied warranties of merchandisability and fitness for any purpose whatsoever. Right? And this, of course, is from the GPL. Oh, same clause, by the way, also in Microsoft's. So his point was, well, geez. So the commitment that an open source programmer makes is, okay, so here's this stuff, which doesn't work. I assert that it doesn't work. I commit to you that it doesn't work for anything. Have fun. And Microsoft says the same thing, except instead of have fun, they say, that'll be $200, please. So we're back to the breakdowns, fixing printers. But now we have a different context here. Now we're worried about the commitments. So when that printer driver breaks down, who's going to fix the defective printer? Now what Richard said was, the commitment that needs to be made by the manufacturer of this printer driver is, when the printer breaks, the user must be able to fix it. And not only that, the manufacturer must be absolved of any responsibility. Now, he didn't actually come right out and say this one out loud. But he did stick it into the license. And the reason you need this commitment is because you're making this commitment too.
But it's not the printer that's broken, though. It's the buyer, right? I mean, isn't that the whole point?
The software part. But I phrased it this way because I'm going to say, well, what if the printer broke? Should the manufacturer of the printer send you the blueprints and say, sorry, there was actually no warranty express or implied for fitness for any particular purpose, but they're the blueprints, and you ought to be able to fix it yourself? We could have such a system. In fact, I suggest this in a thought experiment, although not necessarily with printers. We can do this with pharmaceuticals. Right? You go to the drugstore and you buy a bottle and it has the chemical formula inside. Hey, if you have adverse side effects, there's the formula. You fix it. We commit to you that it may make you sick, and it's not our fault.
That's what they say, right?
No, they would like to be able to say such a thing, but we have laws where they are not allowed to say such things. In fact, I think cigarettes are our most interesting case, because cigarettes actually work as designed. And yet they're still not absolved of the responsibility. Because now we're thinking about, no way, this language action thing, this is all about making commitments. What commitments are we making? So let's think about this like we would think about pharmaceuticals or Ford Pintos or anything like that, you know? What if, thought experiment, we required software distributors to commit? That is, the commitment is not, hey, if this printer driver breaks, you can fix it if you want, but we don't have to. What if the commitment were, if that printer driver doesn't work right, we will fix it, whatever it takes. Ooh, that's an interesting commitment. And then we say, oh, and if you want the source code to fix it yourself, we can make that available too. And I'm suspecting that in the event of the first commitment, you would be less interested in the second commitment. So these two gentlemen, once you find the right context to negotiate this particular language action perspective, are on the same side of the fence. And that was the least inflammatory part, by the way, of Bertrand Meyer's article. You get the same thing with, apologies to my friends at Red Hat, in the clone world. So if you go to the Wikipedia page, there's a list of 7 clones, Red Hat Linux, for which the bits might or might not be exactly identical to Red Hat Linux, and yet they don't have as much traction amongst the user community. I'm not even going to talk about business, marketplace, how much money they're making. The number of people who want to use these are significantly less, and why? Why? Because it's a commitment, right? They think Red Hat is making a stronger commitment than these other fellows, right? Which is an okay thing, because what people are really looking for is not the bits, which is what I think I was saying about the language action perspective, right? The value is not in the content, the value is in the commitment that stands behind the content, and that, in fact, is Red Hat's business model, as near as I understand it. So what is the commitment that we think is the right commitment to be making? What do we think the commitment is that most people want to have? Right? Well, some people want the commitment that, you know, you'll provide the source code if I ask for it. That's a commitment. Some people maybe want a commitment that if this thing doesn't work right, you will fix it. And some people might want a commitment was, well, if this thing is working as designed, but still being harmful to me, and I'd like to change the way it's designed, I'd like to be able to do that. And there may be various ways that you might make that commitment to me. You might commit to doing it yourself, you might commit to allowing me to do it myself, and so forth. So this is the space of commitments that we're operating in. Now, you can make this commitment without making that commitment. But what we're saying with open source, and what we're doing with open source, is a couple of ways. We can look at this from both sides of the divide. Because in 1832, Charles Babbage made the following observation. If you have a work process to be executed that requires different amounts of skill and force, you want to divide it so that you do the skill differently from the force. And this is not only true when you're talking about, we can just replace workman and person here with vendor and company. Right? So that if you have to go to one company to all do all of these things, it's less efficient than if you can break it apart. So this notion of how you manage the labor force, if they are employed by you, is also in fact the same principle that we want to apply to vendors and companies that are providing services to us, because in some sense we're giving them money in exchange for these services. They're in some sense employees of ours. So managing your vendors, managing your supply chain actually is impacted in the same way. So this discussion of professionalism and labor unions and how you organize labor is really the same discussion around how you encourage or discourage your vendors to behave in certain ways. But what we do in open source is what we call log rolling, with no B. Log rolling is a pastime in the American government legislative branch, which involves taking a bunch of things which do not necessarily need to be connected in the same piece of legislation and making sure that they all go into the same piece of legislation so that if you get one, you get them all. All right, this sort of minimizes the amount of decisions that you have to make, but it sort of flies in the face of that tradition that Charles Babbage was talking about in terms of evaluating each one individually on its merits. And so we have that with free software or open source, that we make, we want these freedoms, these commitments from the people who are supplying the software, freedom to run, redistribute, study, and improve, except that we log roll these. It's open source software if you do all four. It's not open source software if you don't do all four. What if you only do three? You lose. You're not open source. Which may be true, but the question is it useful? Is it a felicitous distinction to make? And we do make those felicitous distinctions. If you have the freedom to run and redistribute, we call that shareware, or freeware, or complementary software. Right? And the freedom to study, well, if you have the JDK, you have the freedom to study it. You have that freedom. Right? And there's a freedom to improve. Improve, of course, meaning, well, what do you mean improve? Well, we know what we mean when we're talking about open source. But if there are value to these things broken out separately, then, because I spend most of my time talking to large corporations about these kinds of things, it may be useful to do one or two, or three or four. I mean, you don't have to do all of them necessarily. And it moves you in a direction, and maybe you want to stop before you go all the way, or maybe you don't want to stop before you go all the way. But I think that if we keep trying to bundle them all together and prevent them from breaking apart, we sort of miss some of the opportunities that we might have to change things around. I made a commitment that this would be the last in the Semasiology series, because I realized, in fact, I have stopped talking about the semasiology of open source. Semasiology is about the evolution of the meaning of the word over time, and I'm really not talking about the evolution of the meaning of the word over time anymore, because people's definitions have sort of stabilized and gotten fixed. We don't have to worry about the semasiology of open source anymore. What we're really talking about is the context in which open source makes or doesn't make sense. And the study of the meaning of things as you view them in different contexts is called hermeneutics, not semasiology. And that's all I have to say.
You've been listening to a program from OzCon, the O'Reilly Media Open Source Convention. The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. And if you'd like us to produce new and even more exciting programs in the future, we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. Thank you, Limelight, for your support of the Conversations Network. The post-production audio engineer for this program was Stephen Eng. Our website editor was Liz Evans. The series producer is George Hawthorne. My name is Doug Kay, and I hope you'll join me next time for another presentation from OzCon here on Open Source Conversations from the GigaVox Media Network.